It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
No, I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory, but I would do everything in my power. Just like I don't think masks have to be made mandatory nationwide.
That is Joe Biden just a few months ago. And if you didn't hear it clearly, he promised not to make COVID vaccination mandatory. Now, you might be wondering, Lars, why are you bringing up Joe's broken promises? I know he has a lot of them. When a month ago, on this 9th of September, Joe Biden announced a new rule that requires every single employer in the United States who has more than 100 people on his or her staff to make vaccination mandatory for all employees. And you're still saying to yourself, Lars, we know about that. It happened over a month ago. Well, the president's mandate is a lie. It does not exist. It doesn't exist today. And if you say, well, maybe they're waiting for the ink to dry on that thing. And yet, for the last month, we have seen major companies across America fire thousands of their best workers for a rule that only exists in Joe Biden's head. It may literally never end up existing at all. Now, I'm going to explain that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network on this Columbus Day 2021, or if you prefer, Indigenous Peoples Day. We can talk about that a little bit later on today. And welcome to the radio network that serves up honestly provocative talk radio every day throughout the Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, you are always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Don't forget, naysayers always go to the head of the line. Just make your point up front and be prepared for a few questions from me. So, despite 6 months of promises from Joe Biden and everyone who works for him, including his Secretary of Health and Human Services, they all said vaccination is not mandatory, will not be mandatory. Why? We're not even thinking of making it mandatory. Perish the thought. And then just days later, they reversed that position and they slammed down the rule. Listen to Joe on that.
My job as president is to protect all Americans. So tonight, I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated.
Actually, the number of workers in America affected by this phony rule that did not exist the night he talked about it and in the last month has not even been drafted down on a piece of paper. And there's a reason why, and it shows you just how sneaky this guy is. That was September the 9th. It's not a day that will live in infamy, but it should be. You see, Joe Biden doesn't have the power as president to do any such thing, but he could order the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, known popularly as OSHA, to write such a rule. And you'd likely think, well, Biden announced that he was going to do that, didn't he? Didn't he ask them to write the rule? The answer is no. He's done no such thing. In fact, the White House has a whole office that does nothing but track proposed rules that are being drafted and sent out to federal agencies from the executive. That's Joe Biden. Except that they don't have any record of it either. 100 million American workers find themselves threatened by their employers, and this is creating it's a lot of bad blood between workers and the people they work for. They are threatened with the loss of their jobs, the loss of their paychecks, in some cases, even the loss of their careers, based on a rule that did not exist when Joe Biden announced it and hasn't been brought into existence in more than a month. And I actually think there's evidence that Joe Biden doesn't actually plan to create such a rule through the bureaucracy. And I'll explain the reason why. But I want you to think about this. In some ways, I don't think much of Joe Biden. I don't think he's very smart. I think at this point, he's dimmer than he's ever been before. But just like that Nigerian prince, the one who wrote you the email promising you great riches if you just share some of your bank account info with him, he's not real either, but he manages to con a lot of people by making people believe he's real. Biden doesn't need to actually write the rule. And there's a reason he doesn't want to write it right now. If everybody believes the rule is coming, even when it's not, and they all act like that and threaten their workers, it achieves the same result. This has to be one of the biggest con jobs ever. Listen to his announcement.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this. What more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? We've made vaccinations free, safe, and convenient. The vaccine has FDA approval. Over 200 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin.
Wow.
And your refusal has cost all of us. So please do the right thing, but just don't take it from me. Listen to the voices of unvaccinated Americans who are lying in hospital beds, taking their final breath, saying, if only I'd gotten vaccinated. If only. It's a tragedy.
Now, 24 Republican attorneys general, about half the state, say this is a lot of hogwash. They say that any such rule created by the president or OSHA would be unconstitutional. And we know the history of rules like this. We know what usually happens when they're challenged. But get this, Joe's plan is so smart or so clever or so devious, you take your pick. And I'm not sure it's his plan. It may be from Obama, sitting there in Georgetown, just a few miles from the White House. The attorneys general can't go to court and challenge the rule until the rule exists, and it doesn't exist right now. As Joyce Pullman over at The Federalist writes, the White House, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and the Department of Labor have not released any official guidance for this alleged mandate. There's no executive order. There's nothing but press releases. Now, let me tell you this. OSHA can adopt what's called an emergency temporary standard. That's what the president referred to in the soundbite I ran earlier. But as she points out, an ETS takes up to 6 months to go into effect after the mandate is issued in the Federal Register, which again, for the proclaimed 100 employee mandate, hasn't happened yet. So we're talking about a rule that may never exist, but it certainly won't exist until well into 2022. And if you wonder why the big companies aren't complaining about this, Joe Biden just provided them with the best kind of cover. Once the vaccine came into existence, and when it became clear that a lot of Americans were not crazy about injecting an experimental vaccine that still lets you get COVID, doesn't stop COVID from killing some of them. Oh, and by the way, a vaccine with documented side effects in thousands or perhaps tens of thousands of cases. The companies are faced with a prospect. Should we order our people to get it? Joe just gave them the excuse. Hey, the president made us do it. Even he has not done so, is not doing so, and doesn't appear to ever be planning to write the actual order. OSHA has used the legal authority, according to the Federalist, 10 times in the last half a century. Courts have decided challenges to 6 of those standards, nixing 5 of them and upholding only 1. So even if he writes the rule, it's not likely to win in court. And he knows that. But it can't go to court until they write it, and Joe isn't doing anything about telling OSHA to write it. Joe's done this. Only months ago, he did the same thing with the DACA, the so-called Dreamers, and the Supreme Court slapped him down hard. Coming up, if you were working out the perfect way to attack a country, what are the tactics you'd use? I'll tell you next. I want you to imagine.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
I want you to imagine, if you will, a foreign country attacking our country, America, this way. Turn an energy self-sufficient nation into one begging OPEC and even begging the Russians for more oil, even though we could produce our own but have chosen not to. Fire thousands of police officers around the country so violent crime makes cities very dangerous. For example, Portland police responded to 15 shootings in just 28 hours over this past weekend. One dead, 3 in the hospital, and the city seems all but certain to set a new historic murder rate by the end of 2021. Allow literally millions of poor, uneducated, dependent people, illegal aliens, often infected with COVID, often criminals, to flood across our borders. And with that flood, thousands of pounds of illegal drugs that drive more crime and more deaths in American communities. Fire thousands of nurses and doctors to the point where it overwhelms hospitals. Segregate the population into vaxxed and not so vaxxed. Do this in people's workplaces and in public facilities. use government spending to jack up inflation so it cuts the guts out of the average family's budget, use public schools to indoctrinate children to believe that their skin color defines them, and then threaten their parents who stand up to object at a school board meeting with investigation by the FBI. All the things I just mentioned are not a foreign enemy. They're the actions of the current president and many governors of the United States, or at least the people pulling their strings. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I want to give today's Daily Grill, but it's a mix of both good news and perhaps some good news and bad news, to Governor Kate Brown, specifically for her declaration today of Indigenous Peoples Day, the woke replacement for Columbus Day, which included this line: no matter where you are in Oregon today, remember you are on Indigenous land. Now, that's a direct quote out of the governor's declaration. And I thought, wow, that's going to be great news for all those people who are worried about paying their property taxes when they come due, because it's not your land. And if the governor says it's not your land, maybe she'll buy the idea that you don't owe the property taxes on it. Send the bills somewhere else. Today's best email, but you can always send more, to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Benjamin writes in, "Lars, I had a pretty good laugh when I listened to your podcast over the weekend. A paltry $1,200 subsidy for farmers to buy an electric tractor that doesn't exist yet? Whoever wrote that bill clearly has no idea of what goes on a working farm. The funny thing is, this is nothing new. It's a century old. Back in the 20s, Lenin was obsessed with electric power. Communism means Soviet power plus the electrification of Russia. He declared it, and engineers set about electrifying every aspect of the economy, even when it made more sense to use oil. They had no choice. That includes the agricultural engineers. The batteries to power a tractor don't exist today, and they didn't exist back then. The best design you could come up with was dragging power cables back and forth across the field. You can imagine how that worked out. In the end, Lenin died, and when it was clear that Stalin didn't care one way or the other about electrification, the tractors were left to rust in the field. The decades go by, but leftism never changes." Signed, Benjamin. Now, it's a pleasure to be with you. I heard about a very strange story, and I heard about it by somebody who tipped me off, said, "Lars, you ought to get in touch with Tiana Theron," and I think I'm saying your name right. Tiana, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Am I saying your name right, Tiana?
It's Tiana.
Tiana. Well, Tiana, tell me what you do for a living.
I am a CNA2, which is a certified nursing assistant at Asante Three Rivers in Grants Pass.
Now, how much longer are you going to be in that job?
Not very long. Friday is actually my last day.
And what happens then? Why are you leaving?
Due to the vaccine mandate, they've decided to put us all on unpaid leave if we do have an approved exemption, or if not, we're just straight up getting fired.
Now, which ones are going to be for you? Do you know yet?
I am going on unpaid leave, but I am actively looking for another job. I don't plan on going back to them after what they've done.
Now, here we get to the interesting part. Asante is out advertising to try to get new workers in. Now, you've been part of an effort like that in working for Asante a while ago. What kind of picture did they take?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, they basically told me that I was going to be an advertising campaign for them, kind of trying to rally up locals to work for them. The whole theme was Pacific Northwest, living and working in the area. So they took some pictures of me kayaking at a local lake, and this was about 2 or 3 years ago.
So it looks great. I mean, if somebody sees this and they live in, say, Arizona or Texas or Oklahoma, they say, "My God, I can have a job in the Northwest, and I can go kayaking, and I can see beautiful scenery." And you were glad to be part of it, right?
Right. So I was totally excited. I thought this was a good opportunity to represent a good place to work in a good town, you know.
It sounds like they're still using the picture. What are they using it for now?
Yeah, so I found out a couple of days ago that they are actually now using my picture several years later to advertise my position, my exact position, the floor that I work on, using my picture to hire a replacement since I'll be leaving. And they're also using my picture to advertise other people's, you know, replacement positions. And that was never something that I had agreed to do.
Now, Tiana, this means, I take it in the ad, they're not saying, by the way, see this woman in the kayak? We're firing her, but you can take her job if you want. That's not the way the ad reads?
No, it's just a picture of me with my job position listed under it. I think it was just a very ironic situation. I'm not even sure if they, you know, correlated the two. But after I saw that, I reached out to them and asked them to take it down. And as of now, it's still up.
It's still up. So they're going to keep advertising for new CNAs by showing one of the CNAs without saying this is one of the ones that we're letting go. Now, what are your prospects for finding a new spot? Are you going to be able to find a new one where they'll respect your own personal medical autonomy?
I'm hoping so. I know that Providence in Medford, Oregon is respecting people's exemptions and letting them continue to work. So as of right now, I think that considering applying there.
You know, Tiana, I've heard this from other people. There was a young lady we talked to about a week ago or so who's a sonograph technician. So she does sonography, you know, babies and things like that, but more than just babies. And I said, well, you know, are your prospects dim? And she said, no. She said that Samaritan was hiring up a whole bunch of people who are being, let go by some of the other systems. So it sounds like it's a system-to-system decision, and some of the places are picking up great talent. So I'm hoping you get one of those jobs.
Yeah, me too. I know that a lot of the nursing homes and other places are respecting people's exemptions. And Asante actually sent out in an employee email that the reason that they're not accepting people's exemptions and letting them continue to work is because it put too much of a burden on them. That was
unbelievable. Tiana, thank you very much. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want people to realize the kind of damage that's being done to the country right now. We've got a huge backlog of goods and services that are just not going where they're supposed to go. We've got ships waiting off the coastlines. We've got cargo ports that are stacking up with cargo. We've got store shelves that should have the goods on the shelves, but they're disappearing there because the entire system is log jammed. Part of the log jam is because people don't want to go to work because the federal and state governments have been paying them not to. But there are other collateral damage, or is other collateral damage that's happening. And one of them is the vaccine mandate, especially for those in healthcare. And I know you've heard me talk about that. And you say, okay, that's clinics and hospitals and doctor's offices. And I say, yeah, that's part of it. But one part of it, and I'll admit, I didn't realize it, even though I've had family members who have actually worked in this industry, the industry of foster care homes for medically fragile, developmentally disabled people. And I got this note from Cynthia Lopez, who's a registered nurse, but she wears a lot of hats, and I'll have to have her describe that. Ms. Lopez, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Pleasure to be on.
So you've been a nurse for 25 years, but then you retired from the state nursing program, and you have a foster care home for medically fragile, developmentally disabled people. I told you that my stepdaughter has worked in that industry as well, where she takes care of people who need a little help, in some cases a lot of help, to get through their daily activities. Would you mind describing what this vaccine mandate and the threat of losing your license is going to do for to you and to the people in your program?
Yes. And again, Lars, thanks for having me on. So sure. Like you said, I have been a long-term nurse working as a contracted nurse for the state for 25 years or for 12 years. I've been a nurse for 25 and a CNA for even before that. What I am seeing in, first of all, what made me write to you was that my daughter had sent me a letter saying that, Mom, you really do need to worry about your nursing license. Kate Brown is working to take that away from you with these mandates and rules. And so my first thought was, well, we'll get an attorney because not only do I have to protect my nursing license, which is who and what I am, but now I have to worry about protecting my foster care home. I've got a foster care home with fragile individuals. And as an RN, I am able to do the delegation and the nursing assessments and care plans that are required by the state to keep my house licensed. in addition to that, my house also protects two and takes care of two families. So we're talking about my special needs folks. We're talking about my nursing license. And we're talking about two families that if something happened to this business would not be able to support their families. So what I learned was that as of the 18th, if I don't comply with the vaccine, and I absolutely will not for several really good reasons, that my nursing license would be revoked. If that were the case, then I literally would have to ask one of those long-term nurses or my case managers and all of the amazing people at DD Services to please give me a referral so I can now get a nurse in the house to meet the requirement to take care of my medically fragile people, because this very experienced nurse is no longer able to do it because Kate Brown tells us that without a vaccination, your business will be dissolved. Now, in addition to that, a point I really want to make, Lars, is another nurse had called me this morning and said, have you looked at the Oregon State Board of Nursing website? There's actually a 45-page list of nurses that have been approved from other states already to work in Oregon and take our jobs. So that's that. Whether or not they're vaccinated, Lars, I do not know. But when it really hit real to me, well, when they said they were going to take my license, of course, that's devastated me because it's who I am. But this morning I got a phone call, and I really want to touch on that. I got a phone call from one of my clients who's the mother of a special needs fellow, and grandma and grandpa, who are well into their 80s and 90s, help with this extremely difficult case because nobody else wants to take it on. Well, grandfather 2 weeks ago became severely ill, and he was placed on hospice. There was a referral given. Typically, when there's hospice, those folks are amazing. They're out within 20 to 48 hours helping those families, etc. I talked to my good friend Debbie this morning, and her father, who has supported DD Services, who has supported the state, has yet 2 weeks later to get a hospice nurse. And what Tillamook County said to them this morning was, I'm sorry, we just don't have nurses. There's no nurses. So now this is really real. End of life, these folks are elderly, and they have absolutely no support from the very system that they have paid into forever. And I could go on about the cost of even what it's going to cost me to pay for a nurse or cost the state to get another nurse into my home where I am very competent. I'm very able to manage the care of my clients. It's going to be an additional cost to the state, just another slap in the face. But what I'm doing, Lars, is I'm going to fight back. I'm not going to sit down on my butt no more and just listen and hope this goes away. With your help and encouragement, let's get a voice out there. I was actually quite surprised that you didn't know about this, and why I was surprised, well, I'm not sure. I didn't know about it until my kid emailed me. I didn't get a letter from the Oregon State Board of Nursing. I didn't get a letter from anybody saying, do you know this is what's going to happen to you?
Well, the state of Oregon, which is often, because of privacy and everything else, the state of Oregon is often in the position where they regulate the flow of information. So unless I hear from a nurse or a patient in this case, you go to the state and say, are you having any problems? And they say, no, no problem whatsoever. And they'll tell you it's all hunky-dory. And you say, hold on a second, I'm hearing things. And they're very chintzy when it comes to information. Why? Because if they told people, we're going to leave people at the end of their lives without a hospice nurse for 2 weeks as they wait for hospice care. If they said, we're going to take some of these homes, foster homes, for developmentally disabled, fragile people, and we're going to leave them without nursing care, or they're going to be out searching for a nurse, and they're not going to find one because we've created this problem. Ms. Lopez, they don't want to admit that they've created their own problem. I mean, when I saw more than a week ago, Legacy, blowing out 800 workers. And I wondered, where are they going to find the people to do that? Well, what they're doing is they're shutting down other things and they're going to shortchange. I've heard from nurses that they're being assigned to units where ordinarily they'd work with four patients. They're being told it's now one nurse to five patients, and maybe it'll go to six. But most of that is not done in plain view where any of us can actually see it. The people who are in the middle of that mess know all about it. But unless I hear from them and can bring the stories, that's why I asked you, come on and tell the story, not only of your foster care home and the additional burdens it's putting on that. I had no idea you were going to tell us about a problem with end-of-life care, which, again, most of this stuff, Ms. Lopez, happens out of public view because people have a right to their privacy. On the other hand, when they wonder, why isn't anybody worried about this problem? It's because there's no way to find out about it in the state. Kate Brown is certainly not going to come out and announce, by the way, we've put dying people in a position where they can't get a hospice nurse. We've put people with medically fragile members of their family, developmental disabilities and the like. We're putting them in a box. We're putting the foster care system in a bad way. All of these things are happening, and the state of Oregon, they're just going to tell you, eh, we're handling this all great. No problems whatsoever. And they'll do that all day long. That's Cynthia Lopez, who is a registered nurse, but soon not to be a registered nurse, because as a registered nurse, she makes her own health care decisions, and Kate Brown and Joe Biden don't like it. But then again, they lie through their teeth most of the time. Coming up, I'll get to your phone calls and emails, two brand new anti-gun petitions, and we've got a little musical tribute to the Biden family as we head up to Halloween. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
They're crooked and they're seedy, unscrupulous and greedy. For cash, they're all too needy, the Biden family. Through bribing and extortion, they've amassed a fortune. They lovely term abortion, the Biden family. The big guy received billions for payoffs in the billions, and now they're spending trillions, the Biden family. Son Hunter is an a-hole, he's on China's payroll. Should jail him without parole and throw away the key.
I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
To power they're addicted, they should be convicted. From the White House be evicted, the Biden family.
That is the official, the official parody artist of the Lars Larson Show. That's Jim Gossett, the great and legendary Jim Gossett. We're always glad for his contributions. And he hits it right out of the park almost every single time. And we very much appreciate what he offers. It is the Radio Northwest Network. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails. Let me alert you to something. There are two brand new petitions. If you thought the Pacific Northwest was not already sufficiently anti-gun, consider this from Oregon Catalyst. Just as Governor Kate Brown signed Senate Bill 554, one of the most restrictive gun measures in America, which outlaws lawful possession of a firearm in any government building, including the legislature, airports. It also comes with storage mandates. Two new gun control petitions are now in the signature gathering phase. Apparently, they are on a roll. Initiative Petition 18, and we'll keep an eye on it. It doesn't have the signatures yet to even get on the ballot, would ban the sale of many firearms in Oregon by prohibiting the manufacture, possession, or transfer of many semi-automatic firearms. The measure includes, the list includes 100 firearms examples to be banned, and further states that any similar firearm to this list would also be banned. So that's a great way to write a law. Say, we're going to make this illegal and anything that's sort of like that. I never saw a law that was written that way, but I guess they could. The draft ballot measure says prohibits the manufacture, possession, and transfer of many semi-automatic firearms. Initiative Petition 17 would ban the sale of magazines that contain more than 10 rounds. It also requires a new permit to purchase any gun and a completed background check before a firearm is purchased. Well, you already have to go through a background check when you do a transaction at any FFL. That's true in both Oregon and Washington. The draft ballot title requires a permit just to buy a gun, creates a permit database. So now they're going to keep you in a database. So they know when they go for the seizures later, they'll know whose guns to seize. Glad to have you with me on a Monday on, I guess, either Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day, whichever you prefer. Our Twitter poll today, should the government mandate a gender-neutral toy aisle for the kids? California is going to require all large retailers to provide a gender-neutral toy section. The law has now been signed into effect. The left says current toy marketing somehow affirms gender stereotypes. In other words, there are toys for boys and toys for girls, and they say that marginalizes children. The move oversteps the government's authority in private businesses. Should we have a government mandate for a gender-neutral toy aisle for the kids? I'd say no. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com, our website. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Bill, first of all. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'd like to talk to you about the supposed truck driver shortage.
Yes.
As a unskilled labored truck driver, because we don't have the same protections as a professional, yet they want to call us a professional, my company doesn't really want to give me a raise. And I know a friend of mine who's in the trucking industry, works for another company, he's been there for 20 years, and he hasn't gotten a raise in over 4 years.
Yeah.
So the local Portland area drivers that are working hourly range anywhere from $22 to $29 an hour. But none of the companies want to kind of bump that pay up, and some of the ones that are at like $22 an hour, they've been that way for years. Now, if there's a shortage, don't you think that the rates would go up like they have for McDonald's?
I would think so. I mean, Bill, usually that's Econ 101. A shortage of goods means higher prices. If goods are in plentiful supply, the price goes down. That happens to produce every single year, depending on the season. I've looked online at CDL, what CDL companies are offering. I see some of them talking about north of $100,000 to drive truck if you've got a CDL. What am I missing?
That there's still a lot of trucking companies that aren't at that. I've been at my current job for 5 years.
Yeah.
Now, I personally don't want to leave a job I've been at for 5 years because they refuse to come up to $100,000 a year. I mean, but that's kind
of
where
Bill,
I'm at.
Why not? Why not? If your skills are worth that much money, if other people in the marketplace, and I know there are other factors like the long haul drivers that are away from home generally get paid more. If you want local delivery, that works out better for your family and your life. That may pay less. But if you go to the boss and say, hey, boss, I'm willing to stay for this amount of money, the boss is going to say, good, then I'm not going to raise your pay rate. But if he thinks he's going to lose talented people to his competitors, I have a feeling he'd be willing to. Well, that certainly makes a boss more willing to grant a raise. Thank you so much. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-439-5277. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I want to tell you something. Ordinarily, I would not think of the place where I live in Washington State or Oregon as a place that is notorious for being short of water. And yet, you see some signs coming at us that maybe we will be at some point. So I saw this ad, and it was just an ad that I saw. And I thought, I wonder where that company is, and found out that they're actually located in the Northwest, a place that is notorious, at least on the west side of Oregon and Washington, a place notorious for water 6 months of the year falling out of the sky. And yet that's the location of a company called Tsunami Project. So because I do what I do, I picked up the phone, or actually went online, and I sent a note up to Tsunami Projects and said, will you come on my show and explain to me how you're sucking drinking water out of the air and why there's a demand for your product? So Ted Bowman wrote back to me. He's a design engineer at Tsunami Projects, and he joins me now. Ted, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And by the way, I always tell people if I have a dog in the fight, I have no financial involvement with Tsunami Projects at all, but I think it's a clever idea. I mean, I'm one of these simple guys who understands a few simple things. I know that when my air conditioner runs, that it, through condensation, produces a certain amount of water. It's not very good water. Well, I guess it's good water till it goes through that little tube and runs down the gutter. But that's the basic idea behind the products that Tsunami Projects makes here in the Northwest, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Actually, it is Tsunami Products.
Products, company. Sorry.
And yeah, that's okay. And what we do is we pull moisture out of the air, then we filter it, goes through a series of filtration systems, and then after it sufficiently reaches a certain level, it'll dump into the customer's reservoir, whatever it might be.
And you're not talking about a small amount of water. Like The air conditioner on my house produces, I don't know, a few quarts of water a day. But you're talking about machines that'll suck hundreds or even thousands of gallons of water out of the air?
Correct. It's all relative to the amount of energy that you input equals the amount of water that comes out. For the most part, the higher the dew point rating, the more moisture you can pull out and actually utilize. What we have recently developed in the last year or so is actually a unit for residential. Our first projects were involved with humanitarian aid, like hurricane victims, such where they've had to have water, especially overseas. And then we begin to realize that, you know, more and more people are saying, hey, we've got this problem domestically. You know, is there something that we can use for a smaller application, you know, as a household need? So we kind of jumped on that a year or so ago, started developing this small unit, which we call a T500, which I think is the one that the AP picked up on down in Benicia a couple weeks ago.
So this means when you talk about dew point, it means the machine's going to work and work a whole lot easier and produce a lot more water if you're, say, in Renton or Bellingham or a place like that or Portland or maybe Tillamook, where I went to high school. It's going to work better there than it is in, say, Walla Walla or in Bend or in Pendleton, right?
Well, not necessarily, because the dew point's relative to temperature and relative humidity. So it's always changing, always fluctuating. So if you can compare, for example, three containers, you have like a pop bottle, and then you have a 2.5 gallon bucket and a 5 gallon bucket. Each one of those being half full represents 50% humidity. However, each one of those items, if the small one, the pop bottle would be 45 degrees ambient, and the 2.5 gallon bucket at 75 degrees, and then the big 5 gallon bucket at 95 degrees. As you can just imagine, even if you had 100% moisture at that colder temperature, it's no comparison than if you had the higher temperature with lower water relative humidity. So it's kind of it is a science, and there is a relative thing. It's not linear. It depends on each specific area. So that's a lot of times when people call us, we'll ask them, okay, what geographic area are you in? And then we'll kind of help them walk through this to determine how much they can expect to get out of the machine.
Who do you expect to sell most of them to? And I mean, let's talk about both the small ones for home use and the bigger ones, because it's not something you set on your kitchen counter. It kind of looks like the exterior of an air conditioning unit on a house. And who are you selling the big commercial ones to? And are you selling any here in the Northwest, where we have lots and lots of rain some of the year?
Well, in the Northwest, because of the cold temperatures, once the ambient temperature drops down below about 50, it becomes problematic. You can still get water, but it's not really that most efficient unless you have to have it. The bigger units, however, obviously those are just power hogs, I'll say, but they produce a lot of water in any general area because of the airflow that's going through them. As far as the consumers are concerned, the T500 was built for residential commercial. It is about the size of 3 stack air conditioning units, the condenser units you have outside your house. And that typically in the Northwest, we've experienced about 4 gallons an hour here in warmer environments in Spokane where we test them. We also have a humidity chamber that we can duplicate almost any temperature humidity range in the world. So obviously the higher the temp and the higher the humidity, like down along the southern states, these things they really produce a lot of water.
I was going to say, if you were outside of New Orleans, your machine would be making lots and lots of water without burning a lot of electricity, right?
Exactly. At that rate down there, I don't know what their power rates are, but we shoot for between 1.5 and 3 cents per liter made water.
Okay, so and translating that to English, we're talking about 6 cents a gallon, something like that, 5 cents a gallon.
Something like that. Sorry about the liters.
I know. Yeah, but that's what scientists do. Scientists do metric. The rest of us idiots do English with all its crazy conversions and everything else. So I'm just curious, these things aren't cheap, are they?
No, they. Our last increase we had, commodities are really a problem now with aluminum, copper all over the charts. But our last unit was in the high 20s. It's about 27.5. We're trying to get those back down. But there again, with all the shipping issues worldwide, you know, we're holding close to that, but I can't really say we're going to see a decrease in these, but they are not cheap. However, as one customer said, down in Northern California, he said, if you don't have water, what difference does it make?
Yeah, it does. And not only that, but Ted, the other problem is getting a permit or a water right to be able to drill a well, and a well may cost you into the 20s too, right?
Yeah, even higher than that down in California. I've heard reports of up into the hundreds, and they hit dry holes quite frequently nowadays with the water tables dropping.
So you're going to stay here in the Northwest? Is there a reason the company is here instead of some notoriously dry part of the country?
Well, we started here because of our parent company. Tsunami is its own company, but our parent company, Premier Manufacturing, has been in the precision sheet metal manufacturing for probably 20 years. State-of-the-art stuff here in Liberty Lake. And so it just kind of opened up for us to be here to do that. Even though we don't have the ability to take them outside in the middle of the winter and test them, we've had to kind of, you know.
Well, that gives you an excuse to go to Palm Springs, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, Hawaii is where I'm headed for my next.
Okay. Well, yeah, you got to tell the boss it's warm there and it's really humid there. Got to go to Hawaii for a week or two, right in the middle of winter. That's Ted Bowman. He's a design engineer for Tsunami Products, based here in the Pacific Northwest, making water in one of the places that's notorious for being wet. When we come back, your phone calls and your emails, and talented and gifted kids and the threat against them. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day, depending on whose idea of woke you agree with. I was just talking to the gentleman from Tsunami Products, and Colleen came up with a good question, because a company in the Northwest, notorious for rain, that says we have a machine that will suck water out of the air, basically turning it into drinking water and water for other human uses. I got intrigued by this, and for somewhat the same reason that Colleen asks about. She said, Lars, there have been many a landowner who have received massive fines for changing the flow of a river to divert some of the river onto their own property. How is sucking water out of the air any different than diverting water when it's on the land? Well, I guess if you're changing the course of a river, the state comes in and says, if you're taking water out of that river and you don't have a water right, you can't do it. I don't know how the state would write a law saying you're not allowed to take water out of the air. Now, if it occurs to you that a few years ago, we ended up talking to a guy from Southern Oregon. This guy had a piece of property. He wasn't a rich guy, but he had created an impoundment, basically a little raised dike that held some water back. So when it rained, he ended up with water in there. And he pointed out that helicopters that were fighting forest fires would dip their buckets in there. His livestock loved to drink water out of there. And the state of Oregon, or the city of, I think it was Jackson County in this case, they came to him and they said, that water does not belong to you. And he says, it fell out of the sky. And they said, yes, but the state's view of this, and I kid you not, the state of Oregon views it that while that drop of water is in the air, it doesn't belong to anybody. But the minute it hits the land, anywhere inside the bounds of Oregon or Washington, that water belongs to the state, and you're not allowed to impound it. Or you are, but you're limited to, I think it's 50 gallons a year. You can put one of those big blue 50-gallon containers out. Maybe you get two of them. I can't remember what the details are. I don't do it myself. But they said, literally, you could take water that's coming out of the gutters on your house and fill one or two 50-gallon blue rain barrels, but no more than that. That's the limit. Every other drop of rain belongs to the state. But I don't know how they would go about suggesting that water that is in the air as humidity is off limits and that you're not allowed to touch it. I'm sure that some state lawmaker, probably from the Democrat Party, the party of slavery, is probably working on that law right now. But for right now, you can suck all the water out of the air you want. Just don't touch raindrops that have fallen on your head or the ground or anywhere else. Let's go to Tim in Tacoma. Hey, Tim, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, so I'm a truck driver also. Your last caller at the bottom of the last hour didn't give you all the key information. You're right, it is Econ 101, raise the wages, attract the drivers.
Yep.
However, the industry has gone straight to Econ 104. We do sign-on bonuses in this industry.
You do.
And it's not even up front. For example, the company I work for, which I'm going to leave nameless, is offering a $5,000 sign-on bonus. And if the driver they hire is a referral from an existing driver like myself, I get a $5,000 bonus for the referral.
So you're out hitting every coffee shop along the route trying to find other drivers. That sounds like a pretty good deal for you.
Actually, I'm not, because good quality truck drivers are hard to find, and that's another facet of the Econ 104 analogy. We'll come to that. So okay. The sign-on bonus is you do not get the money up front. Our bonus is structured that you get $500 a month, which ropes the driver in to hanging out for a minimum of his 10 months. This is part of the driver shortage, is because most drivers seat hop. A driver that stays at a company for a year is about the average. Most drivers hop seat to seat throughout their career. And it's because truck driving jobs are so easy to get, it is a driver's market. So some of these companies are offering up to $20,000 sign-on bonuses, and you might get a grand up front. You might get another grand at your 30 or 60 days. You'll get another slice at 90 days, maybe 6 months. Then you get the final payout at a year. That's how they're doing it.
And then do you hop to the next job after that, after you've collected your whole signing bonus?
For another sign-on bonus, yeah.
Okay, you know what? But Tim, do you know what this reminds me of? This is Henry Ford econ, right? Because
people slavery.
I'm not going to go there. I don't agree with that. No, but I don't, because here's what happened. Ford and everybody gets this story wrong, but I've researched it well, and I think I've got it right. Ford found out the going rate for industrial workers back then was $2.50 a day. I know it sounds like a joke today, but it was a lot of money back then.
No, it doesn't.
It's all about economics, right? I mean, what do you think they pay? Well, the average worker in Guatemala, which is why they're all flooding up north, is $1,600 a year. But that's a living wage, maybe barely living, but you couldn't get somebody in most cases for $1,600 a month up here, but it was $1,600 a year down there, or it is right now. So when you say, well, geez, you can easily make that much, heck, you'd have to work hard. Well, you'd have to work hard not to make $1,600. If you're working 160 hours a month, you're making 10 bucks. You're already at the Guatemalan annual income of $1,600. Like 130 bucks a month, which is crazy. But what Ford did was Ford said the going manufacturing is $250, so he paid people $250. And you know what happened? Tim, here's the number that just blew my doors off. He had to have 15,000 people on the assembly line to make the cars he was making. Now, people have falsely said he paid them more so they could buy the cars. If he was selling cars to just his workers, he'd have gone broke real fast. He had to sell to everybody. And what happened was, 1 year, because he was paying the going rate, but it's hard work, he had to hire 51,000 people in 1 year to keep 15,000 people on the assembly line. And you say, well, why'd they leave? Well, because they found out it's $250 a day, but it's hard work. And so an awful lot of people changed. So he was literally flipping his workforce about every 3 or 4 months. So what he did was a model much like you talk about. He said to people, I'll pay you $5 a day, but they don't get paid up front. What they got paid was after they'd been there a year, they got paid $250 a day for the days they were working. And if they stayed a year, then they'd get the other $250 for all the hours they had worked that year. And he found out he cut his turnover rate dramatically, and he didn't have to keep on retraining people, which is a sensible way to run things, don't you think?
Oh, it is indeed. And that actually goes back to the other part of truck driving. Good truck drivers are hard to find. Companies that will hire a guy out of CDL school are hard to find. Most companies want a guy with 2 years or more experience. And then when you couple that out, the truck driving schools don't actually teach you how to do much more than operate the vehicle and pass a CDL test. They don't actually teach you how to drive a truck.
Right. I got that. So, Tim, why aren't the companies working harder? Once they find that good driver, why aren't they paying him a little bit more, saying we don't want him to seat hop?
Because they suckered him in with a big sign-on bonus that he's got to stay tenured for X amount of time to collect.
But at the end of the year, he can go ahead and take his sign-on bonus and walk right out the door and get another sign-on bonus somewhere else. Sounds like they have the problem that Henry Ford had that year when he had to hire 51,000 people to keep 15,000 people on the payroll. Thanks for the call, Tim, and keep it between the white lines. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And naysayers always go to the head of the line on this show. You can also email talk@LarsLarson.com and find our Twitter poll a couple of places. On Twitter, if you don't mind Twitter, @LarsLarsonShow. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website. Account's the same, LarsLarson.com. Now, on Friday last week, I talked to you about the new jobs numbers, which I guess the economists and the news anchors were mostly being very, very diplomatic, saying they were disappointing. No, they were a colossal disaster from my read, but I'm no economist. Economists expected 500,000 new jobs. The Biden economy produced 194,000. I call that a 60% miss of your goal. And I said, look, you had almost as many people drop out of the workforce altogether, called the labor force participation rate. 183,000 people just gave up altogether, while 194,000 got new jobs, 306,000 less than the economists thought. Well, Michael Farron is just such an economist with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I thought I'd ask Michael, what exactly is going on in this economy, and can you sort this out for us, why we have employers who are begging to get workers online? We've got entire enterprises, whether it's trucking, shipping, logistics, or running a restaurant. They can't find the workers to work. We've got the federal government that is paying people not to work. And we've got an unemployment rate around 5% or just below. What's going on there?
Lars, I wish I could tell you what was going on there. And one of the problems that's facing us is some people are saying that we don't know why workers aren't returning to the labor force. That is the problem that I see as the biggest signal coming out of this labor market report, is that we have 4 million workers out there who are just missing. They're not returning to the labor market.
Okay, and my shorthand answer, you know, and I want to ask you about it, feel free to bust it all to pieces, but when the government says, we're going to create a child care tax credit that applies to a lot of families, we're going to be sending you, depending on how many kids you have, $300, $600, $900, $1,200. We're going to give you expanded unemployment. We're going to give you stimulus checks and a lot of other gimmies. We're going to bump up the SNAP benefits or food stamp benefits and all these other benefits. Is that the reason people are saying, hey, if I can get some kind of income that's sufficient without doing any work at all, why would I work at all?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, Lars, and I'm not a naysayer, but I am a devil's advocate. I've played that before, which is probably why I've gone to the head of the line, as you mentioned at the top of this segment. But I'm finding it harder and harder to be that devil's advocate. So there were three main reasons why we thought people were not returning to the labor force. First is they're scared of the virus. That's completely an acceptable rationale, and yes, you probably should avoid work especially if you're in an at-risk population. But with vaccines being available for the last 6 months, that's harder and harder to make an argument in favor of, even in spite of Delta, because we know that that's probably that the vaccines are very effective against Delta. Childcare is another argument that has been made, but half of school districts were back to in-person classes last spring, and all schools essentially are in-person classes now, including New York City. So though that rationale is gone, and so that leaves unemployment insurance and the other benefits that have been expanded during the course of the pandemic. Now, federal unemployment insurance went away at the beginning of September, and people have said, well, the crummy September jobs report shows that unemployment insurance didn't have an effect on the labor market. But there's a lot of anecdotal suggestion that workers have socked away these benefits and have saved them. And I think that that is the rationale that we're not seeing people come back to the labor market. That's the only economic rationale I can give you, although I could give you a cultural rationale as well.
Okay, because Michael, this is the one. Again, you can tell I'm not an economist, but if somebody, even if somebody was very diligent, socked a bunch of money away, took all their stimulus checks and all these other, you know, all this other federal largesse and socked away a lot of it while living on a portion of it, they'd still be looking at a bank account that won't take that long to run empty, you know, or a sock drawer, wherever they're storing it. And they're looking at a labor market where literally there are fast food places that are paying close to $20 an hour, $40,000 a year to take a nearly no skills job working in fast food. And you'd think people would say, now, but are they literally just looking at that little bank account saying I got $4,000 or $5,000 in there and that'll do me for a few months and then I'll look when it's all gone?
Well, I'm worried that that is what we're seeing because, like you said, the labor force participation rate didn't really change that much. It was kind of flat between July and September, and unemployment rate actually dipped. That's actually a bad sign. That's saying that people aren't coming into the labor market to replace the people that are getting hired. So I think that people are just saying, you know what, I'm going to weather things right now, and I'm going to find something that's really good, find something that fits me really well, and then I'll get a job. But the
okay,
problem
let me throw
is,
one.
Is, go Sorry. Ahead.
I was going to say, Michael, let me throw one in, and I should have thrown it in too. Michael Lopez wrote just now, and he said it's the eviction moratoria. And I thought, well, you know, the biggest cost for most people out of their monthly budget is paying the rent or paying the mortgage, except they've all been given a pass on it till the end of the year. And that and if you've been given a pass on the biggest bill you have to pay, well, then, you know, that's like money in the bank.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. And so we're not just talking about the end of federally expanded unemployment insurance. We're talking about the disincentivizing effects toward employment of all these different programs. That doesn't mean the programs themselves are bad on their face. And again, playing devil's advocate, but you can end up with a situation where you motivate workers to stay away from the labor market so long that employers shift over more and more to automation. And I'm worried that the last workers to rejoin the labor market, the pickiest workers, in a sense, are going to discover that there's no jobs left for them, that it's the end of the musical chairs and they have nowhere left to sit. And that's going to cause a lot of problems to grow jobs for those workers into the future. They're going to have to
wait
a while.
Especially
that's my
because,
biggest concern.
Michael, you don't think that it's architects and engineers and highly skilled people. We're probably, if you're talking picky workers, you may be talking people at the other end of the training and skills side who are being offered the smallest amount of money to return to the labor force. They have the least skills. And as you said, their boss is saying, well, if I can't get somebody to do this job, now's the time for me to automate it. Then I don't have to worry about it anymore. And when that picky worker does come back with minimal skills and a lot of rust on those skills from months or years off the job, they're going to find out the job doesn't exist anymore, right?
Exactly. That and what we'd be talking about there is what people called with the Great Recession a jobless recovery. It's not really a jobless recovery. It just means that workers or employers have shifted to needing less labor. And as a result, the jobs aren't there for the workers.
Wow. Ms. Farron, it is always a pleasure to have you come on the program. Although, you know, you're right. This one's a tough one to sort out. I just wish the federal government and the state governments, the 27 or so, the blue state governments, would stop monkeying around with the whole business, with eviction moratoria, with forgiveness for all these other costs, with additional benefits, trying to encourage people to stay away. The last number I saw was 11 million open jobs in the United States. And as Michael Farron points out, those jobs may not be there forever. Thanks very much, Ms. Farron. 866-HEY-LARS is the number to call. That's 866-439-5277. Coming up, I'll get to your phone calls. And have Northwest governments been lying to you to get you on the electric car bandwagon? That's up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Monday, Columbus Day, also Indigenous Peoples Day. And I love that quote from Kate Brown saying, Remember, no matter where you are within the state of Oregon, you are on indigenous land. I suggest that somebody out there who owns property in Oregon should send in their property tax bill with a very carefully worded letter that says, the governor has told me that this isn't my land. So I suggest you send the bill to the actual owners of the land because she just told me I don't own it. But she throws things into press releases all the time. Who knows? I really like this piece by Rachel Dawson. She writes for the Cascade Policy Center. And she says that Northwest governments have been lying to us to try to get us on the electric car bandwagon. And she says, Oregon elected officials and appointed staff love to claim that they base their decisions on the best and most accurate data available. A recent Oregon Department of Transportation study shows that's not the case. In fact, staff are knowingly using inaccurate data to reach seemingly favorable conclusions. Here's what they did. ODOT's Climate Office Program Manager admitted in August of this year that her office was falling short on its vision for reducing emissions from automobiles. Oregon missed its 2020 goal of 50,000 registered electric vehicles. It is also projected to fall short of its 2025 and 2030 goals. As of last month, there were fewer than 36,000 registered EVs in the state. Of those, 12,000 are plug-in hybrids, which still have combustion engines and use gasoline. As part of ODOT's effort, staff conducted a study to identify the gaps in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. However, that study was based on the false assumption that we already meet our state EV goal. The report claims there is an extraordinary need for 70,000 public charging ports and 770,000 home chargers by 2030, 8 years from now. Many of these chargers would be paid for by utility ratepayers and taxpayers, most of whom don't use them. So what she's saying is they've missed the goal to get to a certain number of electric cars. They've fallen far short of it, but then they use the assumption that they've already got to 50,000 and they're going to hit the other benchmarks to justify the idea of the public, through your rates, paying for additional car chargers when, in fact, there isn't any demand for it. Okay, let's go to Jeanette. Hey, Jeanette. Whoop. Jeanette dropped her phone in Kirkland. Sorry about that, Jeanette. Let's go to Tim in Auburn. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I wanted to talk to you about your last conversation you were having. I think one of the factors in where all the missing employees are at, I think we got to factor in the gig economy. Ever since the whole China virus came to town the last 2 years, that's what I've been doing. And there is just an armada of folks doing that. Platforms like Uber, Instacart, which is the one I happen to be on.
Right.
So I just wanted to throw that in because I think there is.
Let me ask you.
And thousands.
I've got to figure out whether or not, do they count you as employed? I mean, I know the IRS counts you as employed, right?
Nope.
They don't?
No, we are not. We are all independent. On all of those platforms, you are regarded as an independent contractor, and so therefore you are responsible for your own taxes.
Well, I get that, but the IRS still knows you're out there making money, right?
Not necessarily, not if you don't report these.
No, but
hold
on, Tim. Tim, when you drive for Instacart?
Yes.
Okay, so you're delivering groceries and stuff like that. When they pay you, aren't they paying you through a 1099? Because they're not paying you through a W-2.
They are, Lars, but I think it factors into the statistics you were talking about. I think in the future it'll come out in the wash, I'm sure, during reporting. But I think just right now, where the heck are all these disappearing folks? Because I know a ton of people, me included, never went back to their normal job. My boss, he called me back up. I did concrete work for years and years. He said, hey, we're working again. I said, I won't be coming back. I'm making more money doing this. It's less impactful on my body,
I think.
And Tim, it works out pretty good.
I mean, you're out there smoothing mud out and making sure that forms are the way they are, and carrying groceries has got to be easier than that, right?
Exactly. Especially at my age at 48, Lars. I'll take it. My
trying about 20 years.
Sure how long this was going to.
I mean, we just finished building a little form for a tiny little pad, 4x9. I mean, that's nothing. And I know how much that hurt. And I said, and I've got a brother-in-law who does concrete work. He know, I mean, they all know how hard it is. So I could see a lot. So what is your boss going to do? Is he going to up the paycheck to see if he can get workers?
Well, he has hired a full Hispanic crew for a lot cheaper wages. And that, unfortunately, that seems to be the route a lot of them are taking.
Sadly true, because Joe Biden's got hundreds of millions of them coming across the border. Let's go to Bob. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was just wondering, that new gun law that they're trying to pass, or that they did pass, or whatever. Here, when the stimulus check started in, 2 years ago or whatever, I finally had enough money I could get another AR-15 on, because I spent 8 years in the Army carrying those damn things. Oh, excuse my language. I'm sorry. And, anyway, are they going to take my gun away from me because I bought it 2 years ago?
Well, here's where they'll start. They're going to it's like being nibbled to death by ducks, Bob. They'll start off, they want to pass two ballot measures, petition 18 and 17. If they make the ballot and they prohibit the manufacturing and possession, is one of them, of many semi-automatic firearms, meaning you couldn't sell it to anybody else in the state, but you also can't possess it. They're going to do an Australia on you and say, you're going to have to get rid of it somehow. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And it's a Monday that I guess is a dual holiday. You can have your pick. It can be Columbus Day. It can be Indigenous Peoples Day. And I'm sure there are probably some people who want to celebrate both, or neither one. In any case, welcome to the program and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to weigh in the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, naysayers go to the head of the line. Wayne Hoffman joins me now, who's president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation. Wayne, your group has taken on, I think, a very important subject here, where you look at what the Idaho Medical Association is doing in targeting doctors who are trying to find treatment alternatives to COVID vaccine. Tell me about what you're doing in that regard.
Well, thanks, Lars. Well, really, all we're doing is making sure that people are aware of the fact that the Idaho Medical Association, which is a special interest group, supposedly representing doctors, but it is a special interest group, is now going around sending complaints in to the State Board of Medicine if a doctor happens to state a different opinion on COVID-19 protocol. So there's a doctor in town. His name is Ryan Cole. He's been suggesting that perhaps you shouldn't get the COVID-19 shot. Maybe you should try things like ivermectin. In any event, because he's trying to spread other kinds of information around that's not part of the medical establishment orthodoxy, they've decided to complain, file a formal complaint with the state medical regulatory agency to have Dr. Cole relieved of his professional license.
So in other words, he's no longer a doctor simply because he said to patients, maybe you should try a different route with COVID, either protecting yourself from it or treating it if you get it.
Right. And it's not, they can't point to anything he's done wrong. And they say, we're not attacking his statements, but all they're addressing are the statements that he's publicly made. He's made numerous public statements concerning COVID-19. They're at significant odds with the commonly understood medical treatment of COVID-19. That's what they're saying.
See,
so
this
if you say the wrong thing, they're going to go after you.
You know, Wayne, this sounds an awful lot like the global warming debate, where if anybody says, well, I'm skeptical about the conclusions you're drawing that human beings are the primary cause. Oh, no, that's accepted science. Don't you dare question the orthodoxy. That now we're extending it to personal decisions. And what they're going after him for is his free speech, because they can't actually tell you what he's actually told his patients up close and personal, can they?
That's correct. And the other thing that you recognize, too, is not only it's global warming, it's critical race theory. If you say anything that's outside of what the media believes that you should be saying, or what the medical establishment thinks you should be saying, or the big tech companies think you should be saying, you're canceled. You can't get on Twitter. You can't get on Facebook. You can't even practice medicine if you want to.
So what's your group going to do about this? Just public awareness?
Well, public awareness. But I think the other thing is, look, if they're going to try to cancel doctors for saying things that they believe to be true, then maybe taxpayers shouldn't be spending their money with these organizations. The Medical Association happens to get quite a bit of money through the state of Idaho managing different medical contracts. And if their attack on this is any indication, they should be stopped. We should stop spending money on the Medical Association the way we're spending money on National Public Radio or spending money with the National Teachers Union. We should stop supporting these organizations through our government infrastructure.
See, and the strange thing about this is I know people are very focused on COVID and the vaccines. But you notice there are some big pharma companies. One of them right now is asking the FDA for approval of some antivirals. And a lot of us, when we first heard word of this about a month and a half ago, we said, so it's not okay to mention hydroxychloroquine. It's not okay to mention ivermectin. It's not okay to talk about your vitamin D levels. But if you're a big pharma company that gives a lot of money to politicians, all of a sudden they've got an antiviral and that one's perfectly okay, even though it's not approved at all by the FDA. The only way they get to sell it is if they get special approval from the Biden administration.
Yep, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember when President Trump said, you know, I think that virus might have come out of a lab in Wuhan. Now that Trump is no longer president, suddenly we're allowed to say, you know, there's a possibility that that virus came from a lab in Wuhan. So it just depends on who's, you know, politically connected, who's in charge, who's got connections to folks that are at the levers of power. And right now you find that the statists have a lot of control and they're going to prevent people from saying things that they don't want said or doing things that they don't want said. And then when the powers that be allow for those statements to be made and those medical protocols to be okay and those rumors to be authenticated, then they're okay with it being said, and that's where you go.
You know,
but it's a real problem that we have right now where everyone is facing, we're all at risk. We're facing canceling from the big tech companies. We're facing the cancellation of our professional licenses. If you say the wrong thing and you happen to be on the wrong side of the political equation right now.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. And I guess what I wonder about, this is standard medicine that they'll tell you, have you got a second opinion? I mean, I've been hearing that since right. I was a little kid. And you say, why would I want a second opinion if I understand that every single doctor out there has been threatened with the loss of their license if they don't give me exactly right. the same opinion on this particular disease? And there are lots of different you could go to your doctor and he might say, hey, you've got a heart problem. We should immediately operate, crack your chest open, and do a bypass. And another doctor might say, well, we can do medication and diet and exercise, and that works just as well. Takes longer, but it requires you to do some things, but we don't have to crack your chest open. And no doctor is going to say, why you should be telling that patient to get the surgery, or you should be telling that patient not to get the surgery. It's all individual based on the patient and the doctor. And if you don't like the diagnosis, go to a different one. But now we're told all the doctors have to march to the same sheet of music when it comes to COVID.
And if you don't, you might lose your license. So think about that. What that ultimately also says is that you're not going to be given the full scope of the different treatment options that are available to you, because doctors are supposed to be afraid that they're going to be reported to the state regulatory agency. And if this is happening in Idaho, you better believe it's happening in California and Oregon and Washington and Montana. It's going to be happening all over the country. It's very, very dangerous.
Well, and Wayne, months ago, I was telling people the EUA, the emergency use authorization that's been at the core of most of this, the FDA's own rules say you can't give an EUA to either the vaccine or to the antiviral drugs if there are acceptable and available alternatives. So right. there's a dog in the fight. If cheap ivermectin is acceptable and available, then all of a sudden the FDA can't give emergency use authorization to anything anymore. And all of a sudden, a lot of pharma companies are out billions of dollars and big losses in what they would have made. Wayne Hoffman is the president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation. When we come back, I want to talk about one real Looney Tunes Portland City Councilwoman and about her crazy ideas as people are getting shot left and right here in the Pacific Northwest. We'll get to that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Monday, Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day, if you prefer, and your phone calls and emails are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately, no showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com and get the details there. Before I get to your phone calls, I want to share with you a couple of sound bites from Joanne Hardesty. And the things you should know about Joanne Hardesty, she is a member of the Portland City Council. If you think the Seattle City Council and Jenny Durkin and Shama Sawant and the rest are radical, Joanne Hardesty puts them all to shame. She is one of the most radical public officials in Oregon, and she hates the cops with a passion. She has said so many anti-cop things that we have talked about. So she was on the local ABC affiliate in Portland this past weekend, and she was talking to Steve Dunn, the moderator of a public affairs program, and he was asking her about the cuts that were made to police services, because as you know, the bigger cities of the Northwest and many of the big cities around America have simply cut their police force back. New York did it to the tune of about $1 billion. Los Angeles, close to $1 billion. Minneapolis did it. And immediately after those cuts, we began to see a gigantic increase in crime. But Joanne Hardesty says the cuts are not the problem. Take a listen.
The three programs that were cut, the gun violence reduction team, the school resource officers, and the transit police, all had a history of racial disparate outcomes. And so when the city council voted 4-1, to actually defund those three programs, what we did was give Portland Police Bureau 40 additional officers that could be assigned to patrol. What the police bureau has is a recruitment problem, not a staffing problem.
Now that is hogwash. And let me tell you why it's hogwash. First of all, it makes sense that if you cut the gun violence reduction team, a team that used to be called the gang team, because what did they go after? They went after gangs. And then some politically correct nonsense came about, and they said, well, we can't call it the gang team anymore because that focuses too much on people of color. This is Joanne Hardesty, who happens to be black. This is Joanne Hardesty's big beef with the cops. She says, well, we had to cut them because they produced racially disparate results. Well, hold on. If you tell the police that a huge number of the violent crimes in a community are committed by people who are members of gangs, and you say, well, who are the members of gangs? MS-13, the Crips, the Bloods. For the most part, there is a disproportionate... Let's put it this way. I'll use the kind of language that demographic folks would use. There is a disproportionate number of people of color in the criminal gangs in America. Are there gangs that involve white people? Yes. Are there a lot of gangs that involve black people and brown people? Yes. And if you go after the gangs and then you change the name of the unit, say we're just going after gun violence. Guns aren't violent by themselves. The people who shoot them are violent. And you say, we have to go after this problem, but we can't produce, as Joanne Hardesty calls it, a racially disparate result. Well, hold on. You want us to go after the bad guys. What happens if a disproportionate number of the bad guys are either black or brown? Well, we can't have that. So they get rid of it altogether. And then she says there is a disparate reaction in school resource officers. Well, guess what? When you take a look at the schools in Seattle and Portland and you ask them about discipline problems, in other words, kids who used to get kicked out of school or suspended for a period of time or expelled, you say, well, does that break down demographically at all? It absolutely does. Most of the problem is young male students, less of a problem, young female students. And then when it comes to color, well, unfortunately, when you look at discipline rates within the schools, they say we're disciplining in a colorblind fashion. But it still means we kick out a lot more kids who are black, fewer kids who are Hispanic, fewer still who are white, and then the best behaved kids appear to be the Asian kids, still people of color. But again, you're going to find the woke folks out there do not consider them as part of the BIPOC group. Now, Take a listen to Hardesty trying to address the question about the dramatic rise in crime we've seen, especially over the last 18 months.
If we gave Portland Police Bureau 40 additional officers with that cut, the cut clearly had nothing to do with the rise in violence and gun violence specifically. We've seen that all over the country where police budgets have been increased, they still have an increase in gun violence. Where police budgets have been reduced, they still have an increase in gun violence.
Now, here's what's crazy about that. She says, gee, we gave them 40 patrol officers. So in other words, officers, God bless them, who get in a car, they're assigned a district. The district then, you know, they drive around the district, and when 911 calls because there's an emergency call in their area, they respond to it. But those people aren't focused specifically on going after the people who are in the criminal gangs, dealing drugs in many cases, and engaging in the dramatic amount of violence. They're effectively ignoring that unless a member of a criminal gang happens to commit a crime in their patrol district during their patrol. Replacing officers who are specifically going after the most violent criminals in our society with people who drive around a patrol district is not going to produce the same result, no matter how many times Joanne Hardesty says it. Let's go to Brenda. Hey, Brenda, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. My name's actually Brenda.
Brenda, I'm having a tough time hearing you. Are you not close to your phone? Brenda, you're very muffled. I don't think Brenda can hear me. Okay, Brenda, it is so hard to hear what you're saying that I don't think, if I can't hear it wearing headphones, I can almost guarantee that the people who are listening are not going to hear it. So I was going to make time for Brenda instead. We'll see if we can get her to a cleaner cell line, but she's very muffled. Instead, let's go back. I want you to hear Hardesty's comment about gangs. Take a listen to this soundbite.
In February of this year, we aired a story where you said Portland does not have a gang problem. Our investigative reporter says that according to police, a significant number of shootings in Portland this year are gang related. Has your thinking changed on whether or not Portland has a gang problem?
There's been no data presented to me that proves that we in fact have a gang problem. If we do, we need to have a strategy to address that. But we cannot have a one-size-fit-all approach to the diverse reasons why violence is taking place in our community.
Now, this is what's crazy about that. Let me put this in context. She says we don't have a gang problem. Over this last weekend, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, Oregon Live, ran a story by Maxine Bernstein, a big, expansive story about the fact that Portland is on track to hit a new record number of homicides. And they say about half of those homicides involve gang activity directly. So Joanne Hardesty, who claims there's no evidence out there that says gangs are the biggest problem, and then she goes on to say, but if we do identify gangs as part of the problem, we should have a specific strategy aimed at them. The city used to have a gang unit. Then they had to rename it to make it politically correct and call it the Gun Violence Reduction Team. And then under Joanne Hardesty's influence, they got rid of the unit altogether. Joanne Hardesty is lying to the public. She knows it, and she knows better. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, Columbus Day, and also Indigenous Peoples Days, if you prefer. Joe Biden is still pushing on that reconciliation bill. Congress, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I have this sneaking suspicion they will end up passing something. And that the best we can hope for is it'll be fewer trillions of dollars than they originally proposed. But one of the things you should know about what goes into that is the climate change nonsense that's included in all this. And Steve Malloy knows that well. Former member of Donald Trump's EPA transition team and the founder of junkscience.com. Steve, welcome back and tell us what's in that bill that Americans likely don't know about.
Hey, Lars. Well, thanks for having me back. Well, the most important thing that's in there climate-wise is the federalization of the electricity grid. So if you've liked how COVID has been managed, you're going to love it when the feds regulate how you get electricity. Wow. They have this, I don't know how else to describe it, sort of a Rube Goldberg-esque scheme where they're going to both pay and penalize utilities if they don't increase the amount of wind and solar they have every year. And by 2030, you know, I mean, this is scheduled to happen between 2023 and 2030. They plan to have 80% basically carbon-free electricity, and they only plan to spend $200 billion doing this. You know, the value of our grid is about $5 trillion. Even if it was a worthwhile plan, there's certainly not enough money. And the only thing I can conclude from the whole thing is that this is just a power grab. It has nothing to do with actually, you know, changing the grid, making it better in any way.
You know what this seems like, Steve? I mean, remember when you've read the history. I wasn't there, and you weren't either. But when Edison came up with the light bulb, I think it famously or infamously took him 10,000 tries. But it didn't happen because Congress said, make it so. And then all of a sudden, Edison gets this flash of brilliance and comes up with the first electric light bulb. It happened. So when they say to all these power companies, make it so. Make it all carbon free. Oh, and by the way, if you can't quite meet that goal, just pay us a lot of money and pass the cost along to your consumers, your ratepayers. Isn't that the more likely outcome?
Yeah, well, no. The outcome is control, federal control over all the utilities and the grid, because no one will be able to meet the crazy standards that have been set. And there's no plan there. You know, there's nobody in the utility industry. There's nobody on Capitol Hill that has done any sort of analysis to show how this is even possible. It's not a serious plan. It's just a power grab. It's like the rest of climate. Give us the power, give us the money, and forget about it.
Well, except for one factor. I mean, I've told people sometimes my read on utility companies is if you say build some solar or build some wind, they say, okay, because they know that they get cost plus. In effect, most utilities are, you know, the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, and the public utilities just say whatever it costs us, and we get to add a certain percentage for profits on top because that's part of being a regulated monopoly, whereas everybody else has to make a bottom line. So if they say, we want you to build power plants that cost twice as much, they say, okay. And they just pass along the cost of the twice as expensive power plants plus 8 or 10% for their, you know, for the folks who own the utility, which, you know, you say, well, that's not fair. I said, well, how would you have them do it? At a loss? They won't be around very long. Yeah. And then it'll be the government running it directly instead of the private utilities. But if you go to them and say, every time you go past a certain carbon goal, you have to pay a bunch of money to the government, that's money the utility companies don't have to actually provide the service to their customers. So doesn't it put them in even worse shape for being able to supply what we expect from them?
Yeah, well, you know, and really the implication of all this is that, you know, people need to get involved, because if you think that the utilities are going to defend you or even defend themselves, you know, if you think utility managements are going to do that, you are sadly mistaken. I mean, they're just going to go along with what the government tells them to do. They don't care. They've always done that. As you pointed out, they make costs plus their guaranteed returns. They don't really care. They don't have, you know, other than as human beings and Americans, they don't really have any skin in the game. They just don't care. So it's really up to the rest of us.
Yeah, and in fact, in some ways, it's worse than that, Steve, because if I run a company and I get 10% above or whatever the number is, I know they get a regulated amount because they agree to be a monopoly, but then, you know, so they can't charge what the market will bear, but they can charge a percentage above what they spent. So if they make a certain percentage of $1 billion that they charge to ratepayers, that's a certain amount of money. If they make 10% of $2 billion
right.
or $5 billion,
right.
that it actually has a perverse incentive in it that the more they spend, the more they end up making because they make 10% of whatever it costs. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. It's this whole cost plus idea. And of course, they make more real dollars when there's bigger figures included because their percentage stays the same. Of course, until the government really takes control of everything, and then they'll be sorry. But until then, they'll go along with it, and that's kind of the problem. So the rest of us have to, you know, stand up, step in, and get involved. And it's not something that the public is really used to doing. You know, where people think that the utilities are, well, no one likes their utility.
Well,
but,
that's true.
But you might think that they're looking out to make more money, and well, they are. And well, there you go. Maybe we should.
Well, except for one thing, Steve. You know, without the government's intrusion into this, if a utility company said, we're going to make power as cheap as we possibly can, and then we'll sell a lot more of it, you know, because they understand the reality is if they start supplying expensive power, well, they do make 8 or 10% on top of that. They understand when rates get to a certain rate, and in Southern California, I understand they're already 30, 40 cents a kilowatt hour in some areas. I've heard from people about that. And they say, geez, we're paying this much. I said, then everybody tries to use less. Well, if that's your goal, that's fine. But if the company wants to sell a lot of power, it doesn't try to jack the price up. It tries to bring the price down. But we, you know, now we're not going to let them do that.
Well, yeah. So the climate thing has completely perverted, you know, utility economics and really all economics. And the goal is to reduce emissions, which doesn't make any difference because there is this country on the, well, there's two countries on the other side of the world, China and India, which, you know, are burning coal like there's no tomorrow. So no matter what we do here is completely useless. But the government wants us to pay more for electricity anyway. And by the way, you know, the means that they want us to produce electricity, wind and solar, well, don't really work. As a matter of fact, the reason we're in this huge energy crisis now is because wind has failed in Europe, and it has just forced gas prices through the roof, and we're going to be feeling it in America this winter.
All of this while they're trying to talk people into changing their homes over to all electric heat, and while they're trying to talk people into driving electric cars, because if you charge away from your home with an electric car, I've already seen electric car enthusiasts saying, I'm paying about the same amount I'd pay for gasoline. Well, my answer would be, wait till your electric bill doubles and see how much you're paying.
Well, yeah, and then you've already paid more for your electric car. You know, you're paying more for less, and then you're going to be paying more to fuel it up. Of course, it's not even really possible because how are people who live in apartment buildings or garden complexes or how are they going to fuel their cars? Was every parking space going to have a charging station? I mean, the whole thing is just nuts. And then on top of all this, you know, none of these materials or very few of them are produced anywhere outside of China. So we're just making ourselves dependent on China. We're enriching China. We're not accomplishing anything emissions-wise or convenience-wise. It's, you know, green is a total disaster.
Oh, but Steve, you've left out the Congo and the wonderful materials we get from the Congo. We're providing jobs for 5 and 6 year old children who are in indentured servitude. I mean, after all, it makes a woke liberal, it just warms the cockles of their heart when they think about all those little 5 and 6 year old kids in the Congo digging out whatever it is, cobalt or something else, to make sure their electric car can run and they can brag about how green they are. Steve Malloy from JunkScience.com. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's Columbus Day. It's Indigenous Peoples Day. And Kate Brown sent out a statement saying today, no matter where you are inside the boundaries of Oregon, in this case, I haven't seen one of these from Jay Inslee yet for Washington, but no matter where you are on Indigenous land. That's a direct quote out of her statement. So, rather than send in your property taxes this year, just tell the county that you live in, I'm sorry, this isn't my land. I'm on Indigenous land, according to the governor. I don't owe you any property taxes. Maybe go and see them about it. To your calls now. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or one of their three locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Let's go first to Dennis. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Oh, happy Columbus Day. So I'm sitting on my tractor building a carport for my new electric car.
You are?
And I've wanted to call you. But yeah, I wanted to call about this for a while. And today you've been touching all my hot buttons.
Okay.
So I know a PUD commissioner, and he said, Dennis, you don't seem like an environmentalist. Why'd you get the electric car? And I said, it's fun to drive, has lots of power, lots of torque. I don't think it's good for the environment. I don't know. It certainly isn't any better for the environment. But I told him, I see it as my responsibility to load the grid as heavily as possible, as quick as we can, so that we can see that the laws that they're passing are stupid.
So the minute we load the grid up.
Kind of smirk.
Yeah, what'll happen is you know that the Northwest Power Planning folks have said that we're headed toward brownouts and blackouts. And I just wonder, you know, California got a taste of this when all of a sudden they said, we have to turn off your power because of wildfire risk and because we don't have enough in the grid. I wonder how those people got to work the next day.
Right. I know someone that's down in California, and they're putting in solar and batteries because they don't have power. And they live very close to the Bay Area, and they just bought a Tesla. It's something that I think is important for us to understand, that we can pass laws and we can say it's great that we don't use carbon-based fuels, but what's the replacement? And there's no answer. And we won't make a change until we can feel it.
No, and I guess you're right. So it's just that, Dennis, I worry that when people say we'd be better off to hit the wall, hit that brick wall hard so everybody realizes what we're up against. And I said, yeah, except that the collateral damage of that is going to be extensive in some cases to some people, depending on their situation. It may be permanent. It may be the permanent loss of your job. And if you say, well, how does my job relate to electricity? Our radio station uses a certain amount. I've seen the power bills. They're pretty extraordinary. But they aren't anything like what happens if you work in manufacturing. Can you imagine the folks who make the jet engine fan blades to go in all those Boeing jets? And they use a gigantic amount of electricity. And electricity is a big part of deciding whether or not their product is in this country is worthwhile or not. And when the power bills go up, they'll have a huge incentive to move their plants somewhere else on planet Earth. Let's go to Glenn in Klamath Falls. Hey, Glenn, thanks for listening on KFLS. What's on your mind today?
I'm curious, Lars, if Wayne Hoffman from the Idaho Freedom Foundation requested to come on your show, or did you ask him to come on your show?
We reach out to people, but sometimes people say we have an issue and they reach out to me. I mean, I've had a lot of nurses on lately. Some of them have asked to be on, so they get their piece said. So I reach out to them. So does it matter?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to present both sides of the story. Dr. Cole is a pathologist. He does not actually care for COVID patients. I believe he probably makes money from COVID testing. He's not an intensivist. He's not an internist, hospitalist, or infectious disease specialist. He does not attend very ill COVID patients. And his opinions are on COVID are far from the mainstream of practicing medical physicians who are taking care of ill patients.
I take it you are a doctor,
so I think we need to present both sides of the story.
You know what? I got to tell you, Glenn, I've been asking people from the Oregon Health Authority for now more than 1.5 years, and including the guy who calls himself the state epidemiologist. Just to be fair, we should point out, you know that Oregon's state epidemiologist is not an epidemiologist, right?
Right.
Okay, so, and do you think that maybe the governor should say, by the way, the guy we've been calling the state epidemiologist and making all these critical policy decisions for the state is not trained in epidemiology, as long as we're being honest about things?
I guess that's really what I'm calling is I'm trying to give you the other side of the story.
Because we have about 1 minute to the break.
Dr. Cole's opinions are not that of mainstream medicine. Actually, people taking care of ill patients who are being overwhelmed by COVID in many cases.
Do you think there were a lot of people who weren't in the mainstream who had to drink hemlock back in the day?
Perhaps. This is not back in the day. This is today.
Well, no, this is in modern times where we have literally said, if your ideas are not part of the mainstream, you are forbidden to say them out loud. You're forbidden to give advice to people. You're forbidden to be on social media. You're forbidden to communicate through all the modern means we have for communication. And to me, that's dangerous. That's not science when you say we will silence you if you don't speak what's in the mainstream. It's not science.